The following episode of Annals on Call is brought to you by Annals of Internal Medicine. The views and opinions expressed by the hosts and participants during this episode are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of the American College of Physicians, the editors of Annals of Internal Medicine, or the institutions that the speakers are affiliated with unless so identified. All relevant financial relationships have been mitigated. Information contained herein should never be used as a substitute for clinical judgment. For more episodes, links to CME and MOC, or to view disclosures, visit go.annals.org/oncall.
Prior authorization wasn't originally for medications. It was for things that cost a lot of money back then. A hospital admission, a big surgery.
Welcome to Annals on Call, a podcast based upon articles from the Annals of Internal Medicine in which we discuss the implications of the article for you, the listener. This is Dr. Bob Centaur. I'm Professor Emeritus at the University of Alabama at Birmingham and former Chair of the Board of Regents for the American College of Physicians.
This episode of Annals on Call discusses an article titled Prior Authorization and Clinical Authority, Time to Recalibrate. The author of this article, Dr. Gustav Weiland, who's an assistant professor of internal medicine at the Virginia Commonwealth University School of Medicine, is our guest. We hope you learn about the problems of prior authorization and some of the suggestions we have for trying to make that less of a problem. Gustav, thank you so much for joining the podcast. I read your ideas and opinion piece about prior authorization, and first I felt badly for the patient, then badly for you, and then angry at the system.
Yeah.
And so maybe you could tell us the story, because it's really, really a very important story.
Yeah, so I think after it all happened, I was just sitting around on a Friday morning and just thought that I'm not the only one going through this as a physician. And so the story about the patient is that he moved back to the United States. So he had actually been seen in our clinic before. So he had a very well-established diagnosis of type 2 diabetes, like no question about it. And so he came back and from overseas and he had tirzepatide with him. And he was doing really well, wanted to continue the medication, obviously. He lost a lot of weight. His A1C got a lot better. Our last charted one was like 9.2. And his ended up being less than 6.5. And so, yeah, why wouldn't we continue the medication? It's working really well. You have some comorbid conditions where you'd benefit from it. And so we wrote the medication and his insurance denied it because they said he didn't have the criteria for type 2 diabetes mellitus, which they utilized a A1C of 6.5. So that was obviously upsetting for the patient and me. Because we knew that that wasn't true. I think the salt in the wound was that after reading the denial, it said it had been reviewed by a clinical pharmacist. So when you look at his chart, there had to be other claims for his other medications. Metformin, he had two other GLP-1s on file. We verified that the lab data was sent, including the A1C being high, and even random blood sugars, just to make sure that, hey, this gentleman has type 2 diabetes mellitus. And so that made me really question whether or not that was reviewed by a healthcare professional that understood his health history. And it kind of goes into this treatment paradox where the medication, his tirzepatide, successfully controlled his diabetes. And now that success is threatening his eligibility to get the medication. So it's almost a perverse incentive to remain ill in order to continue it. So I think a really strong analogy is we don't stop. If you have high blood pressure, we don't stop antihypertensive medication because the blood pressure is now controlled. We don't stop statins because your LDL is at goal. Yet with GLP-1s, that's being questioned anytime a patient's doing well. They lose weight, their A1C gets better. You know, now's time to come off the medicine in some people's eyes.
So, approximately how much time did it take you and your team to do the put all the data together to finally get approval?
It had taken a couple months actually, because the first time it was denied, saying that the hemoglobin A1C wasn't done in the past calendar year, which wasn't true. And it was a back and forth with the insurance company. And a couple months later, it got overturned. So fortunately, he had a little stockpile of tirzepatide from his country. So it ended up working out okay, but it took a lot of time. It took an appeal letter. It took we have a large prior authorization staff that handled it with us. So it took a lot of work to get it approved.
The fact that you actually have to have a prior authorization staff seems. So you're spending money in your practice to have a prior authorization staff because prior authorization has gone so far off the bandwagon.
And I think it's you really have to go back and look at why it was started in the first place. Prior authorization wasn't originally for medications. It was for things that cost a lot of money back then. A hospital admission, a big surgery. And so later on down the road, when we've had a lot of advances in medication, obviously, and medications have gotten more and more expensive, but prior authorization for medicines didn't really expand until the 1990s and 2000s when pharmacy benefit managers began applying it to prescription drugs. So, there are a lot of instances where, you know, it can reduce healthcare spending when it's targeting systems or services that are overused, like I guess not following practice-based guidelines, or overuse. So there's one case that in Medicare Part D that looked at a there was a prior authorization program for ambulance, non-emergency ambulance transport. And that prior authorization program saved $1 billion over 4 years. I think as you know, being an outpatient physician, we encounter a lot of prior authorizations with expensive imaging, CT scans, MRI. And so there's some data suggesting that prior authorizations can control costs there. And then when you look more into the medication realm, like Tennessee implemented an NSAID prior authorization program to basically steer doctors towards generic rather than brand name medications, and that saves some money. But I think the common theme with this is the prior authorizations. Those are successful because those are strong examples of inappropriate utilization. So now we're in a situation where prior authorization is being applied everywhere. And I think when you look at the evidence of that, it becomes a lot less convincing. There was a study published this year by Kaiser Family Foundation that looked at Medicare Advantage plans and prior authorization requests, and over 4 million prior authorization requests were denied. And this kind of goes into the burden of doctors and staff and administrative, but only 11% of those denials were appealed. So you have to question, is the appeal process too burdensome? Are doctors just giving up and writing whatever the insurance company suggests? But when you look at that subset of data, if the doctor decides to go through with the appeals process, over 80% of those appeal denials were ultimately overturned. So you have to question, did it have to go through the prior authorization progress process to begin with?
So, how much of this is related to artificial intelligence? And I'm a big fan of artificial intelligence. So, I'm going to let's talk about how that's being used by these companies and why blaming it on the AI. I'm going to say it's not the AI's fault, it's the way they the questions that AI has been asked to look at. But is AI part of the problem today?
Yeah, I agree. I agree with you. I'm a big AI fan. I think it's going to change a lot of the things we do in practice. But then again, AI is, if it's being used by insurance companies or doctors, it's only going to follow the rules that it's given. So if the rules, the counterpoint is if the rules are evidence-based, transparent, AI could actually make prior authorization go really well. But right now, when you look at writing a medication in the EHR, I don't even know if it's if a GLP-1's on the formulary. I don't know what is required to get it approved. And so I tell patients I have to send the medicine. The only way I'll know for sure is when it gets denied and they have to tell me why.
Well, that's to me a really sad state of affairs that it's not explicit to us as physicians what they're going to pay for and what they're not going to pay for. And it's also not explicit what criteria they're using. In your case, they told you what the explicit reason was, but that explicit reason didn't have the insight of really looking back and understanding who the patient is and why they're where they were, as you so nicely explained to us.
Yeah, no, the process is not, it lacks any transparency. It lacks any accountability. I think that's what led me to write the paper is using AI, if AI was used in this case, I'm not sure. But certainly the thresholds are being utilized. And so when over 40% of the country has obesity, GLP-1s are an excellent example of why this isn't working out.
So I have two last questions for you. A lot of physicians, a lot of your colleagues are going to be listening to this. When do you decide to fight with the insurance companies? And what do you do?
I think it's when we're using criteria like an A1C, like a BMI, like a coding. As you know, in internal medicine, there's a lot of gray in medicine. The example with the patient, his does he have diabetes or not? He has diabetes, but it's well controlled. So the question is, where do we go from here? And making sure that we're in the driver's seat, not that an insurance company is telling us what to write. We're deciding what to write. So I think that's the biggest concern that I have moving forward is patients need to understand when an administrative policy, not their doctor, is limiting or delaying access to recommended care.
I'm going to hope that the ethics committee at ACP is reading this and listening to it, because in my mind, this is an ethics issue. In my mind, the ethics of the insurance company being able to tell you that your plan, which is clearly the accepted way of taking care of type 2 diabetes, is can't be authorized. And that's actually, to me, unethical for them to have done that in the first place. Now, I may be going beyond my lane, but I don't think so. I really think that we need to reframe this as what is the ethics of what they're doing. And I've seen multiple cases of friends who had to fight through this, and I worry about all the people who didn't fight through it.
So I think there's a growing desynchrony between what is FDA approved, our clinical judgment, and insurance comfort coverage. So the FDA tells us if something's safe and effective, right, for a specific indication. So GLP-1 for obesity, BMI greater than 30, A1C greater than 6.5. So the at we as doctors, we determine with the patient that you would benefit from the treatment, right? That the patient would benefit. And the insurance company is now determining whether or not the patient can receive the medicine. So, we should be asking the question whether insurers should be defining the menu of available treatments when a medication already has an FDA-approved indication, and if a doctor believes that it's beneficial for the patient. So I was looking at the Annals article, and there was a comment from a physician organization about an inherent conflict of interest when insurers make determinations about the clinical appropriateness of services for which they are also financially responsible. So I think it's becoming, an ethics issue, a policy issue. So and technology, including AI, should make our life better, right? It should make prior authorization faster, obviously with the formulary stuff, make it more transparent and less burdensome, but it's really slowly taking away our autonomy as what we think is right for the patient.
Well, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. And I think that you've raised some very interesting questions, both for those of us who practice and but certainly for those of us who try to influence policy.
Thank you so much.
Now it's time for Bob's Pearls. The problem of prior authorization and the story that was so heart-wrenching that Dr. Weiland gave us reminds us that we need to be willing to challenge illogical prior authorizations that deny logical treatment. It is both our right and our obligation to do that. But the other thing that I want to do is hope that the American College of Physicians Ethics Committee will look at this. The prior authorization does not always consider all of the issues with a patient and why things are happening. We need some better protections from irrational prior authorization, whereas we need to agree with reasonable prior authorization. This is a complex issue. I hope this has made you think. Thank you for listening to our podcast.
Information contained herein should never be used as a substitute for clinical judgment. For more episodes, links to CME and MOC, or to view disclosures, visit go.annals.org/oncall